states would be carved out of this land. And that the procedures are basically still in effect today. So when Alaska and Hawaii joined the Union, it was pretty much under the procedures that were spelled out in the Northwest Ordinance in 1787. And so again, that's really the most important legislative action that predates the U.S. Constitution, because that was the Continental Congress that passed that. And then in it was actually a couple years later, it was re-ratified by the U.S. Congress under the Constitution, kind of to put to rest any question of whether it had continued validity. Now, there are a couple of things about the Northwest Ordinance, because it's this organic act, and an organic act is the term used when Congress creates something new, like a new territory. So it's the organic act for the territory, and it specifies the government. So the Northwest Territory was a territory more or less the same as, you know, the Virgin Islands or something like that today. It was a territory, it was an organized territory, so it had a territorial legislature, it had a governor, it had judges, and it had a county subdivision. So it was fully organized as a territory. It continued to exist until Ohio became a state, because the Northwest Territory basically consisted of everything Ohio west of the Mississippi. And when Ohio became a state, the remaining territory was carved off, and at that point, everything became the Indiana Territory. And then when Indiana joined the Union, with its current borders, everything left over became the Illinois Territory. And then when Illinois got statehood, it became the Michigan Territory, and then the Wisconsin Territory. So that's the Northwest Ordinance, was primarily the organic act that created those units of government. But the Northwest Ordinance also contained, prior to the Bill of Rights, it also contained the Bill of Rights. For example, it said, the inhabitants of the said territory shall always be entitled to the benefits of the writs of habeas corpus and trial by jury. So it specified a lot of those individual liberties in it. And in many cases, it purported to act in perpetuity. So in this case, it said the residents of that territory shall always enjoy the right to trial by jury. Also, kind of obviously a very significant historical issue with slavery, the Northwest Ordinance said that that territory shall be ever free of slavery or involuntary servitude. So it's an important Bill of Rights, and it purports to act in perpetuity. Now, we, as part of the CLE, I'm supposed to cover ethics in a general manner, so I'm going to do that now. And what I will tell you is, do not cite frivolous cases, because that's a bad, non-ethical thing to do. And the reason why that comes up is because, unfortunately, a lot of times when these things get cited, they get cited in kind of a frivolous manner. So, and I have a quote here, for example, from some habeas corpus case or something. You know, it's a prisoner filing a pro se suit. You don't want to get an order from the court to open it up and read it that says something like this. A review of the complaint reveals that plaintiff is attempting to bring this action under the Declaration of Independence and the Northwest Ordinance. However, neither provides plaintiff with a cognizable basis for his suit. So, you have to take some of what you're going to learn today with a little bit of grain of salt. I think you're reasonable enough to realize that. You're not going to find today that this act of the territorial legislature in 1800 and something is still in effect. And when I show this to the judge, he's absolutely going to rule in my favor. Well, that's probably not going to work. But where these things are very helpful, I think, is kind of showing the historical perspective. and showing that things are long-standing precedents. So when you cite, when you have your string cite with 50 cases, tacking in some of these 100-year-old cases at the end, I think really adds a lot of value to it, because it's easy for a judge to look at something and say, the Court of Appeals held that last week, but, this case is a little bit distinguishable, so I think not pay attention to that case. But if you have 100 years of precedent on your side, that's more helpful. And indeed, frequently, there are cases that say that the Northwest Ordinance is no longer the law, but on the other hand, it is cited somewhat frequently as mostly as an aid to construing later provisions. So in other words, take what you're getting today with a grain of salt. You're not going to get that one piece that's going to break things wide open, but hopefully you can still add some value to the arguments made. Moving on then to our first actual history lesson, which I think is a really interesting chapter in Minnesota history. As I explained, when one state entered the Union, a new territory was typically carved out of the land that was left over. Well, Iowa was admitted to the Union in 1846. I explained that this was originally Louisiana territory over here west of the Mississippi. It went through kind of rattling off those states earlier, I was talking about the part east of the Mississippi. There is a similar chain here, which I'll explain in a minute, is not quite as significant. But it originally started out as a Louisiana territory, and most recently, before statehood, it was Iowa territory. Iowa basically was this chunk, and then the state of Iowa, the current boundary, was admitted in 1846. And Wisconsin was admitted in 1848. Well, unlike on previous occasions, no specific provision was made for this leftover territory. A specific new territory was not created at that time. And the status of this country up here, which is now Minnesota and the eastern half of the Dakotas, kind of fell into some question as to what the status of what that was. Presumably, arguably, there was this land with no government and no laws. However, some historians have looked at that and kind of said, there was no government there. But I think as lawyers, when you look at that doesn't quite make sense, that there's just totally no government and totally no law in this territory. I mean, somebody commits a crime, something ought to happen, you would think. And I think the answer is that, yes, there did continue to be some government there, and there did continue to be laws that had been in effect previously. One famous quote on this, and I'll give you the background of this, why this speech was given in a little while, but Henry Hastings Sibley, who was later the first governor of the state of Minnesota, not of the territory, but of the state, who had been a fur trader in Mendota, he was giving a speech in Congress, and he makes the argument, and it's quoted here, he says, either this territorial organization exists or does not exist. And he says, this authority gives us the power to choose other officers. And it sounds like there were officers functioning in the territory. Probably not full-time judges, but I believe there were justices of the peace. And also the Board of County Supervisors of St. Croix County, Wisconsin, as far as I can tell, did continue to function and to meet. And there were officers functioning under the auspices of the Wisconsin Territory. So despite what some of these historians have said, that it kind of lapsed at our